Welcome to Discovery's podcast. We're glad you're joining us today. If you'd like to know more about us, you can check out our website, dc2.me, or follow along on our socials. And now, here is this week's sermon.
Well, good morning, friends. My name is Zach. I'm one of the pastors here, and just want to begin by saying, no matter what you've done or what's been done to you, you are welcome here, and I'm really glad to get to share part of this morning with you. You may be looking around the room, if you're used to being here, going, there are a lot of shorter folks in the room right now. Is this some like weird half rapture where the Lord took half of the people and left the lower halves? And we have been painting our basement all week this week, just trying to give it a little bit of a facelift down there. And so before we move all the furniture back in, we just needed a couple weeks to have kids up here. So kids, if you're in the room, I'm pumped that you're here, man. Thanks for being with the old crusty people today. A couple other things before we get into our teaching for today. There's a couple big things that are coming our way that I just wanted to bring your attention to. The first is that every year we take nominations for elders, and the nomination process is open right now. You can find this on our website, and that nomination process will close at the end of September. If you're somebody who calls Discovery home, these are the folks who lead you. I carry the title lead pastor, but frankly, these are the folks who run this church. And so the fact that we as a congregation come together and say, who do we want to lead us? This is an important movement for us as a church every single year. So if you have called Discovery home, or if you know people here and you just know, I've got people that I can see across the room right now that I know, they listen to the Lord, and I would trust them to lead a local church. And they carry humility and discernment and the ability to lead. I would just love to invite you, please nominate those folks you've got about the next month. One of the things those elders have been working on for a little while is actually tasking our land use team to consider our eastern parcel and what's going on with the affordable housing project that we've been talking about for a long time here at Discovery. It's had a lot of different iterations. Over the last couple years, this land use team has taken a new crack at how could it look and work to have affordable housing built right here on our property. And so right now, you can go to the website and begin seeing some of the work that they're doing. But on September 7th, following service, we'll have just a big session to share everything, and we won't do Q&A then. We'll do Q&A about a month after that, just to let things settle in and to get our heads wrapped around it. I want to be super clear. What is being shared is not plans. This is exactly what we're doing. Let's go. What we're sharing is this is the work the team has done. This is what we'd like to start putting in front of developers who would then be the ones coming in saying, what do we need to change about these plans to make it actually work? So that's where we're at in the process right now. Stay after service on the 7th for that. We'll record it too if you'd rather just watch that on your own. All right, let's get into our teaching for the day. And this is a question that I think is for everyone. So regardless of whether you're 3 or 103, what's something that you would choose to do nonstop for 100 years in a row? If you're like me, the first thing that comes to mind is tacos. I would do tacos for 100 years in a row. Some of you, your answers, I actually have done this, is Monopoly. I have played Monopoly in one game for 100 years. That thing takes forever. I would assume that for some of us, the first thing that comes to mind is 100 years is a long time. I have had some lingering dinners with family or friends. I've had some times around a fire pit, often accompanied by marshmallows and chocolate, and then regret after you eat the marshmallow. I'm like, that could have gone on for 100 years really easily. What would you do for 100 years straight? There's a group of people that chose to do something like this. It started in about the mid-1700s with a real weird German dude. His name was Count Nicholas von Zinzendorf. And if you shave my beard and put it on the back of my head like a mullet, we look the same. So that's really fun. But von Zinzendorf was a wild cat. He came from a huge family estate. I mean, a family of deep wealth. And at the same time, in the region of Eastern Europe, there was a lot of just bad stuff happening. And so refugees were coming over the border. And if you're like, this sounds eerily familiar to our context, this dude, Nicholas von Zinzendorf, so cool. As these refugees were coming over the border into Germany, he said, hey, you can come live on my family estate. And this group of people generally were referred to as the Moravians. And he said, you Moravians, you can live here. And a lot of these Moravians knew Jesus. They were practicing Christians, but they were all from very different places. And so the ways that they practiced Jesus were really, really different. And out of this generous heart that he had, have come just live on my family estate. Von Zinzendorf found himself regularly trying to break up fights. Things were not going well with these Moravians. And one thing that he began to realize was, man, if we can just agree on some very basic principles, I think we can learn to get along here. And for those that call Discovery Home, just as a fun aside, one of the phrases that they loved using in the early, and I think this is roughly where it begins, is in the essentials, unity. In the non-essentials, liberty. And in all things, charity. This is the group of people where those roots begin. But as they continue to take in these people and form this community, this wild thing happened. They started praying one night. And this prayer lasted for 100 years without stopping. Somebody was always continuing the prayer. It was almost as if this baton of prayer was being passed from one person to the next, as somebody would say, my watch is done, and it is time for yours to now begin. Incredible. What would you do for 100 years? And I think if I asked that question at first, feel like me, like tacos, prayer didn't necessarily make the initial list of things I would do for 100 years. And I think if some of us are honest, we're like, I actually still don't know if I would like to do that for 100 years. There must be something fun about this for them. The way that they were doing it, whatever they discovered in this community, something about it must have made it be so awesome that they couldn't stop. I mean, 100 years ago, you're talking generations. People began and died twice over in the midst of this process. Something was radically fun about this kind of prayer. What does prayer feel like to you? Does it feel like a playground? Like, this is a place I could just never leave. And I wonder if, as we maybe dig into a part of what these Moravians were about, if there's something for us to be discovered of, could prayer be more fun than I'm giving it credit for? Could this be a place where if I set up shop and maybe did it a little differently than I'm used to, I might just stay for a good long while? One of the gifts that the Moravians gave then to church history was movements of prayer. And in our contemporary context, one of those is a group of people called the 24/7 prayer movement. I don't know if you've heard of this group, Pete Grieg, and some really, really incredible people. But they are a group that has set up this system of, we're going to continue praying 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. And every now and again, they invite churches into this. Would you as a church consider a week of prayer where you're praying nonstop together? And this is the invitation of this series that we're in on prayer. Can we do this together as a church? And I don't know that our real, like, tooth-sweet thing is we have to have every slot filled for an hour. The invitation is, let's come together and pray. So before we get into the teaching, I just want to be clear of what's coming as we get to the end of this series. It's a week of prayer that we're doing with the 24/7 prayer movement, that the 24/7 prayer movement is doing with the global church. And so this will be starting the week of August 31st. I'd love to let you know, like, there's two strong invitations in this. I would love for you to sign up for at least 1 hour slot to pray during this week. And the second is, we'll be having events every night of the week here at the church. I'd love for you to just come and attend one of those events. So here's how you'd find that. If you go to our website right now, at the bottom, you'll find this button, this Discovery 24/7 Prayer. If you click on that, that will take you to this main landing page. And on here, there's a couple things I would point out. The first is, if you're like, how do I add a prayer request? Like, if I want to be prayed for, have somebody I know that needs to be prayed for, or I want to see what people need prayer for because I signed up for a slot, what am I praying for? You can click on this button. That'll take you to this page. Give me that next one, Sai. And then you can ask for prayer or to pray for others. All those buttons will take you to all of those lists. That's there for you. So know that that's there. The other thing is, if you're like, I want to sign up for a slot or two or seven to pray, all over this page are these sign up for a slot buttons. If you click on that, that'll take you to a page that looks like this. And you can choose which day of the week, that particular week, what hour. If you're like 2 a.m., you're darn right, because that's crazy. You don't have to sign up at 2 a.m. Somebody else who's crazier than you will. But what would it look like to pray? And what might happen? And part of what we'll do as we get towards the end of this week, too, is there's a final button on that landing page that I didn't circle yet. It's called just response to prayer. What happened? Do we pray with expectancy, or is it something that we just kind of roll over and limply say things to heaven, and is that it? The series that we're in is based off of a book, so if you're a reader, one thing I would just love to encourage you to grab is a book called Praying Like Monks, Living Like Fools by a guy named Tyler Statton. He's actually the chair of the board for 24/7 Prayer USA. This is what that book looks like, but it's a great read, particularly if you're like, I'm just beginning to check out prayer. I want to engage it in a fresh way. But this particular week, with all of that preamble now being said, this week we're going to talk about the prayer of confession. Like each week as I preach today, I would love to invite you for sure to listen. But as much as I would like to think that you're listening to me, it's just the best to be able to come to church and listen to what the Lord is saying to you. And so for all the things we're about to talk about, I mean, tune in, but tune in to what he's up to in you. Because for some of us, this is a challenging subject. For some of us, this is something we don't really think about very often. For some of us, this is delightful. What's the Lord doing in you today? Our teaching for today is based out of the book of Psalms, which if you're going to do a series on prayer, Psalms is like the book that you go to. Psalms 32, and we'll just do the first six verses. It says this in the Message translation. Count yourself lucky. How happy you must be. You get a fresh start. Your slate's wiped clean. Count yourself lucky. God holds nothing against you, and you're holding nothing back from him. When I kept it all inside, my bones turned to powder. My words became day-long groans. The pressure never let up. All the juices in my life dried up. And then I let it all out. I said, I'll come clean about my failures to God. And suddenly, the pressure was gone. My guilt dissolved. My sin disappeared. These things add up. Every one of us needs to pray. When all hell breaks loose, when the dam bursts, we'll be on high ground, untouched. I find confession to be a loaded word. You say that, and like depending on somebody's background, it can mean a lot of different things. What is not confession? Let's start there. I was talking with a friend this week and talking about her background in church, and she just said, yeah, just confession was the time that you were taught to feel bad about yourself. Another friend said, I was just taught to consider what I've done wrong, what I am doing wrong, what I will do wrong. And I was talking with another friend who said, it's just this, there's this self-imposed damage that's been done, and my church helped, but I've really just held on to it, that I am a vessel for shame, and that when I hear the word confession, my head and my whole body just deflate, and I'm left thinking about all the things that I have done wrong. And honestly, when you hear the word confession, honestly, what comes to mind for you? For some of us, it's a pleasant thing. You've had good experiences with this idea. For some of us, we recoil. Some of us know that there's work to be done here. And the good thing is, especially if you're hearing that word and coming from a place of going, that's twisted up inside of me. The whole story of Scripture is about a God who loves to redeem twisted things. So could it be that this is a good thing? So what is confession if that's what it's not? I love that kids are in the room today for this particular sermon. These are our kids. And if anyone gets this idea of confession, I do wonder if, like kids, you're not a total full step in front of all the old people in the room. And why? It's because there's an understanding when you're a kid that you're young and you're figuring it out. You're learning. You're going to get things wrong. That's not a big deal. But you're also regularly surrounded by authority. So whether that's I'm at home and I'm with my parents, or I'm at school and I'm with my teachers, there's just adults around. If something's going wrong, there's always somebody there to help me out, to correct me in that. When I'm at home with my three sons, when they get an argument and one of them wrongs the other, they generally will come straight to me or mom. You have to be a parent to experience it. But you don't have to be a parent to muse at the idea of how these conversations go. Do I want to humiliate one kid in front of the other? I don't think so. Do I want these kids feeling so ashamed to the point of locking themselves in their room or considering running away? Am I just punishing them? I don't think so. And some of us have grown up in families like that. Some of us have grown up in communities like that. And I would just say that's not good. Like in the fullest definition of good, that's not how this confession idea works. What is good? When my kids come to me and they've been in a row, I want them to learn to live in harmony with each other and to keep that harmony with each other, both with each other, but then also that brings harmony to our entire house. There's a collective, a communal experience to this harmony. Kids experience this dynamic all the time. They're well practiced. If you want to learn about confession, watch kids. Watch how this works. And what adults often are missing, I think, is exactly what kids have. I need, if I'm going to engage this, the assumption that I am learning. Because at some point in human development, apparently you like flip a switch and you're done making mistakes, like somewhere post-college, I guess. You're just supposed to not do that anymore. And I fall into that trap. And the second thing I think that kids have that I'm missing is I need the belief that I'm not my own authority. That there are other people around, not just who I can turn to say, what should I be doing differently, but to say, this is a mess. How do I find harmony again with my brother? What is confession? I think if we dive into what the definition of this word means, it helps us out a little bit. The word comes from the Latin a little bit. The conjunction of the words com and fateri. Com meaning together, fateri meaning to admit. So we're going to together admit a thing. That sounds roughly like confession, I suppose. If we go back into the Greek, the Greek word homologeo, this definition more is along the lines of is to say the same thing or to agree. My spiritual director would say to have the same tongue, that our tongues are literally saying the exact same words. What is confession? Let's leave that up on the screen, actually, Sai. I think it's just helpful to just chew on this a little bit. Confession certainly means that we admit what we've done wrong. But in the early church, if you were to use the word confession right away, they think of something quite a bit different. It was the confession of what you believe. Is that I confess Jesus. That's my confession at the end of the day. Augustine wrote an entire book called Confessions, and all it was him saying, here's what I think is true. That's a little bit of a different lens on what confession is. Does that match up with a definition like this? And for sure, while for us today, confessing means acknowledging our wrongs, I wonder if part of what the early church has to offer us in this conversation is it also means declaring what you believe is right. Confession is agreeing on what is true with God. And for some, we have only agreed or been taught to agree in confession with some of what God says. What I have done wrong, God, we agree. I've done something wrong. And we deflate and we hang our heads. And all we can hear is the words total depravity playing on repeat in our brains. But we are invited to agree with all of what God says. That confession wouldn't just be an act of declaring that we've run away from home, but also a declaration that we have returned. David White is an Irish linguist and poet. He loves to dig into the meanings and just like pontificate on what words mean. But this one on confession, I was like, that is so beautiful. White says this, confession is a stripping away of protection, the telling of a truth which might once have seemed like a humiliation, becomes suddenly a gateway, an entrance to solid ground, even a first step home. To confess is to become free, not only by admitting a sin or an omission, but to profess a deeper allegiance, a greater dedication to something beyond the mere threat of immediate punishment or the desolation of being shunned. To confess is to declare oneself ready for a more courageous road, one in which a previously defended identity might not have been shorn away, but seen to be irrelevant, a distraction, a working delusion that kept us busy over the years and held us unaccountable to the real question. I love what White is onto as he's thinking about confession. This is not just admitting what's gone wrong, but what true ultimately looks like. If I'm left thinking I'm bad, if I'm left in confession just feeling shame, then I have yet to fully say what God says. Confession means engaging also my belovedness and my calling, my true self. Confession, I think, if we're going to do it this way, demands time in Scripture, just reading the Word. Because if I'm going to have this interaction with a God, if I'm going to dare to believe that I am the beloved of God, I've got to know that first. Before I enter into this conversation,
So this discipline of reading Scripture and being in the Word, it plays a part. I surely must leave confession each time with a foolish grin on my face, thinking he did it again. He came for me again. He died for me again. And he has invited me to live a resurrected life with him again. That's incredible. And when that's my experience, that's not just my experience. It suddenly becomes the experience that I begin offering to other people. Over a third of the parables that Jesus told were parables around the theme of forgiveness. Why? Because if that rabbi is going to dare to say, you should love even your enemies, that better come from a heart that is used to being forgiven themselves. So why do we confess? Statton says this in his book, Living Like Monks. He said, God did not lower the standard of holiness. He found a way to make us holy that isn't dependent on our performance. And I think what Stanton's getting at here is holiness is still expected from every single one of us. Wherever you are on your spiritual journey, know that that is still the invitation of a God who is holy. That is the expectation. And while that may sound suffocating to us, we just finished this series on the book of Leviticus, a book that is predominantly about repairing this relationship between us and God. How much of that book was about confession? That was like the whole core of that book. And what we find, even going back to Leviticus, and it's just reinforced by the cross, is a story of a God who's saying, look, I expect holiness. I will handle it. You don't have to perform your way to me. I'm coming all the way to you. What a delight. What a good story. Confession puts us in a right relationship with God and with each other. As the psalmist in Psalm 32 says, when I kept all of it inside, my bones turned to powder. The pressure never let up. And when we're not living as our true selves, we're just made up actors. We're unrecognizable even to ourselves. We become sick as we hide more and more of who we really are. We're just not meant as a human being to keep up a facade. We were meant for freedom. It's that idea from 2 Corinthians, where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is freedom. You are meant to be free in the fullest sense of the word. And anything that invites you to hide pulls you away from that. Brennan Manning, in his book, The Ragamuffin Gospel, says this, freedom in Christ produces a healthy independence from peer pressure, people-pleasing, and the bondage of human respect. And I would just pause right there and say, do you see yourself just in those first words? The tyranny or public opinion can manipulate our lives. What will the neighbors think? What will my friends think? What will people think? The expectations of others can exert a subtle but controlling pressure on our behavior. In Christ Jesus, freedom from fear empowers us to let go of the desire to appear good so that we can move freely in the mystery of who we really are. What is confession? I think it's just being honest with yourself and confessing everything that's true. Not just, here's the things I've done wrong. Here's also the things that are good. And not good because I've performed my way to them, good because there is good to be confessed. Why don't we confess? I wonder at two reasons. I think both have a huge umbrella of sub-things under them, but if we can boil it down, I would say it's either because we want to appear like we have it all figured out, or because we're really convinced that everyone else has it figured out. If I want to appear like I have it figured out, it's interesting how many people on their deathbed, I'm a pastor, I haven't gotten to have this experience a ton, but I've had it a couple times, where on their deathbed, somebody all of a sudden is like, I need to just say it all. If you've heard the idea of a deathbed confession, this is what it's like. Why? I think because at the end of your life, your ability to cover up, your ability to hide things, there's just a finality to what's in front of you that you're like, there is no point to hiding this anymore. I want to be honest because with what's coming next, I need there to be a sense of myself. I need to find who I am and I need to share it with other people. Why do we wait until our deathbed for this? Isn't there a freedom that comes with living this way all the time? And I just find I don't confess because I've worked hard to manicure my costume and my mask. Every day is Halloween. And I want to make sure that how I'm seen is respected and that I do have it all figured out and that I'm okay. There's nothing to see here. Towards what end? Towards looking like I have the answers? Towards looking like I'm no longer learning, I'm no longer on a journey? When I say it out loud, I'm like, that is ridiculous. But I think I do believe that a lot of times. And also, I think, again, considering our young friends, why don't I want to confess? Well, because then I don't have to confess that there's an authority over me. I am the authority in my own life. I have no vulnerabilities. If I disagree with somebody else, we are just at odds, and that's how it is. But to say, no, there are people who are, there are human beings who I put in authority over me. And even beyond that, there's a Lord in heaven, and I put myself under his authority, and I hold both of those things. Why don't we confess? Either because I want to feel like I've got it all figured out, or because I think everybody else has it figured out. I think Richard Foster said this so well in Confession of a Discipline. He said it this way: confession is a difficult discipline for us because we all too often view the believing community, the church, as a fellowship of saints before we see it as a fellowship of sinners. We feel that everyone else has advanced so far into holiness that we are isolated and alone in our sin. We cannot bear to reveal our failures and our shortcomings to others. We imagine that we are the only ones who have not stepped onto the high road to heaven. Therefore, we hide ourselves from one another and live in veiled lies and hypocrisy. So why do we confess? Because if we're honest, vulnerability is the natural state of a human being. Not just physical vulnerability or emotional vulnerability, relational vulnerability, although all those are certainly true, but spiritual vulnerability. We are a culture that loves pride, but humbleness, that actually fits a human soul a little bit more naturally. So when we confess, we're vulnerable. We are honest with God and with each other, and if we're really digging into this, the real bummer of confession is how much I end up hiding myself from myself, and confession helps me to find myself again. When those relationships are right, between me and others, me and the Lord, and me and myself, all of a sudden there is freedom to be fully alive. I can connect with other people. I can know and be known, and suddenly the fundamental need of my soul, love. I've actually now created an environment where I can be loved, not a version of me. And that is my deepest longing. How do I confess? In the mid-1700s, same time as von Zinzendorf, there was an Italian Catholic priest by the name of Alphonsus Liguori. And he gave a simple outline of how to confess. And for those of you who are like, seriously, all this work and now we're going back to the Catholics to learn how to confess? Yes, yes, we are. Because I would say, as somebody who would identify as Protestant, confession is probably one of the disciplines that we have left behind to our own peril. And so to recover it, to go back to the group of people who still to this day, there's things that get fumbled, there's a lot of shame, and these folks have stuck with it. So I want to learn from them. He said there are three ideas that come with this act of confession, and I'm going to add a fourth for us today, because we need it. Liguori said this: for a good confession, three things are necessary. The examination of conscience, sorrow, and a determination to avoid sin. So let's take these piece by piece. First, this examination of conscience is not just me walking through my own list of wrongs. This act of confession, if you're like, this is brand new to me, I've never done this, or I've never done this without sitting in a box next to a priest that I can't see. Like, I'm inviting you to practice this. So this may even be something when this slide is full, there'll be 4 points. You might want to, like, do one of those, take a picture. Practice this. Examining your conscience is not just your list of things you've done wrong. This is an invitation to a conversation saying, God, will you show me the areas that are in need of forgiveness, of healing inside of me? It's not just the wrongs that I've done. This act of confession, this conversation with the Lord of show me things, it also engages this idea of what are the false things that I believe? Because if I'm going to confess with the same tongue and say the same things that you say, there's a lot of things I believe that are not things that you say, and that's fundamentally what I'm trying to get at here. If I find myself at the end of examining the conscience, only finding ideas like I'm bad, I'm alone, I'm hopeless, I'm unwanted, I would just encourage you, stay in it and continue to ask the Lord, like, is there more truth that you have to offer me than that? And I think that you will find it. And I would encourage you, get specific as you can, not just I did this one thing or I believe generally bad things, but how specific can you get? A specific healing often leads to specific transformation, maybe not right away, but be specific. And if you're like, I don't even know where to begin, like I'm generally unaware of how messed up I am, which I'd love to think I'm really aware, I'm not. To just pull out, this is going to sound super old school, but pull out the Ten Commandments and just read through that and just see like what begins to bubble up in you. How close to the mark do you find yourself hitting? That's step one. Step two, confess your sorrow. Oh, this is so, the first time I read this, I'm like, these freaking Catholics. And then I dug into this and I'm like, these guys are amazing. Confess your sorrow. This is not primarily as an emotion, according to St. Alphonsus, although emotion may be involved. As he talks about it, he said, sorrow is an issue of the will long before it's an issue of the heart and the feelings. So to confess my sorrow means that I begin by seeing my desire to do wrong. And I confess that. I know my day in and my day out. I know the things that I do. I know the things that I'm prone to believe. And I just seem like a moth drawn to the flame. I just keep leaning that way. God, I confess my sorrow at this. And yes, for sure, I feel bad about that. But my desires are wrong. And so I invite God into that desire to engage and transform my desire to his own so that not just my tongue, but my entire life begin to speak the same things that he speaks, that we would agree on my life. Step three, confess your determination to avoid sin. Again, first pass, I'm like, that is roughly worded. But what if this is an idea that says, ask God to give you a yearning for what's good and right and beautiful? It's a confession again of your desire. But I think sometimes, depending on how you've grown up, if you've grown up with confession, there's just a sense of like, I say all the bad things and then I just kind of hang there in suspended space. And I think with this part of the movement, this is a confession that you want your desires to match with his. If sorrow has helped me express that something's gone wrong, this step helps me express my desire to step into what is right. And I would just say, I've been pretty thick on this idea of confession being between us and the Lord, but this is also between other people. And so with this particular step, if you're confessing to another person a wrong that you have done to them, this is important to do in person. It's not just something you go, Lord, and I handled it. I don't need to say anything to you. The personal experience, brothers in harmony, that matters. Settle it as soon as possible, according to Jesus. So that's St. Alphonsus. I'm going to add a fourth component to how to practice confession, and it would be this. Confess your forgiveness and come home. This is a part that I think most of us have not been quite encouraged enough to include in our confessions. Without the cross and the resurrection, the discipline of confession could just be a mindfulness exercise. But it's so much more than that. It involves an objective change in our relationship with God and our subjective change in us. It means healing and transforming of our inner spirit, something in our story that is now stemming from God's story. What does it feel like to be forgiven? Can we confess, man, I'm just washed clean? With kids in the room, it felt like a good thing to read a story today. So kids, if you'll indulge me, I don't know how many of you have read the Chronicles of Narnia books. One of those is called The Voyage of the Dawn Treader. Adults, you may have heard this story like me, like hundreds of times, and every time I'm like, tell it again. I love that story. And for those of you that are familiar, you know right where I'm headed with this. We're going to jump mid-chapter into this thing, so let me give you some setup. There's a boy named Eustace Scrub, and he almost deserved it. And Eustace is a bad kid. He's just a total punk. Everywhere he goes, he's just whiny. He's always getting people in trouble. Everything is about him. Total narcissist. And one day, he's on this voyage. He's with his two cousins and then this motley crew of Narnians, this foreign people. and they come upon this island. And Eustace is just having a pity party for himself. He takes off into the forest. He goes back into this deep ravine. He takes a drink from a pool when suddenly he realizes he's not alone in this valley. And he becomes aware that behind him is a dragon. And this dragon has been protecting a horde. But this particular day that Eustace is there, something really wild happens because this dragon drags itself out for one final drink by the pond that Eustace is taking water from, and then the dragon dies. And Eustace is like, party! I got a ton of gold all of a sudden. And he goes and he puts this big bracelet on his arm. And he's shoving jewels and coins into his pockets. And he falls asleep. And he wakes up at some point and he sees smoke all around him. And his first thought is, that dragon, he hustled me. He wasn't dead. He's here right now and he holds perfectly still. But the smoke doesn't stop. And then he starts to notice that his hands, he can't even see his hands because the dragon is standing over him. And then he starts to move his hands and he starts to realize that he is the dragon. And in this moment in the story, as we're beginning to understand this character of Eustace Scrubb, we understand that what's come to the outside of Eustace is everything that he's tried to hide from himself that was going on in the inside. Eustace is a dragon. Until this moment where something happens and he's telling his cousin Edmund what happened after the fact. It says like this from Eustace. Well, anyway, I looked up and I saw the very last thing I expected. This huge lion coming slowly toward me. And one strange thing was that there was no moon last night, but there was moonlight where the lion was. So it came nearer and nearer. I was terribly afraid of it. You may think that being a dragon, I could have just knocked any lion out easily enough, but it wasn't that kind of fear. I wasn't afraid of it eating me. I was just afraid of it. Do you understand? Well, it came close up to me, and it looked straight into my eyes, and I shut my eyes tight, but that wasn't any good because it told me to follow it. You mean it spoke, said Edmund? I don't know. Now that you mention it, I don't think it did, but it told me all the same. And I knew I'd have to do what it told me, so I got up and I followed it, and it led me a long way into the mountains. And there was always this moonlight over and around the lion, wherever we went. So at last, we came to the top of a mountain I'd never seen before. And on top of this mountain, there was a garden and trees and fruit and everything. And in the middle of it, there was this well. And I knew it was a well because you could see the water bubbling from the bottom, but it was a lot bigger than most wells, like a very big round bath with marble steps going down into it. The water was clear as anything. And I thought if I could get in there and bathe, it would ease the pain in my leg. But the lion told me I must undress first. Mind you, I don't know if he said any of those words out loud or not. I was just going to say that I couldn't undress because I didn't have any clothes on when I suddenly thought that dragons are a snaky sort of thing and snakes can cast off their skin. So, of course, I thought, that's what the lion means. So I started scratching my scales off all over the place. And then I scratched a little deeper and then instead of just scales, there was whole skin that started peeling off beautifully. Eustace does this process and as soon as he gets ready to go into the well, he's turned fully into a dragon again. So one more time, he takes his claws and he begins going a little bit deeper this time. And then right before he goes in the well, they're all back. And a third time. And then the lion said, but I don't know if he spoke. You will have to let me undress you. I was afraid of his claws. I can tell you, but I was pretty nearly desperate now. So I just laid flat down on my back and I let him do it. The first tear he made was so deep that I thought it had gone right into my heart. And when he began pulling the skin off, it hurt worse than anything I'd ever felt in my life. The only thing that made me able to bear it was just the pleasure of feeling the stuff peel off. You know, if you've ever picked a scab of a sore place, it hurts like billy-o, but it is such fun to see it coming away. I know exactly what you mean, said Edmund. Well, he peeled the beastly stuff right off, just as I thought I'd done it myself. The other three times, only then it hadn't hurt. And there it was, lying on the grass, only ever so much thicker and darker and more knobbly looking than all the others had been. And there I was, as smooth and soft as a peeled switch, and smaller than I'd been. and he caught hold of me. I didn't like that much, for I was very tender underneath now that I had no skin, and he threw me into the water. It smarted like anything, but only for a moment. And after that, it became perfectly delicious. And as soon as I started swimming and splashing, I found that all the pain had gone from my arm. And then I saw why. I turned into a boy again. You'd think me simply phony if I told you how I felt about my own arms. I know they've no muscle and are pretty moldy compared to Prince Caspian, but I was so glad to see them. I was hating everybody back then. And by the way, I'd like to apologize. I've been pretty beastly. What does it feel like to confess your forgiveness and to come home? Eustace used words like delicious, painful, restorative, the gift of getting yourself back. You've got to be careful that this is also not just a feeling that you're chasing, but an invitation to be practically right with yourself and towards God and towards others. And if done well, we are returning to who we truly are. It's not a momentary breath of air that we come up for before returning back to what we think our lives should look like in this costume. In this story, Eustace is changed. He still has moments that are unsavory, but it's the author's way of letting us know that perfection isn't the outcome of confession. Learning, recognizing the authority over us is. So this is how we begin. And perhaps this is one final why of why we engage confession. Again, back to our friend Tyler Staton. He said it like this. Why do we confess? The desperate need of our time is not for successful Christians, popular Christians, or winsome Christians. It is for deep Christians. And the only way to become a deep Christian is through the inner excavation called confession. The pathway of spiritual maturity is descent, not ascent. I began by telling you a bit about the week that will cap off this series, this week of prayer, this 24/7 idea, and the Moravians. One wild thing I learned this week, I've been hearing about the Moravians for a long time, but I did not know what started the 100 years. I just thought they got together and they just liked praying. What started 100 years of prayer is that von Zinzendorf continued to experience, y'all are fighting all the time. Like you're coming with these different beliefs, these different ways of practicing your faith. You're all these different churches. What does it take for us to be together, to be a whole united front? And these Moravians began on a particular night after a church service coming together and saying, we need to confess, we've treated each other really poorly. And this confession went on for a full day. And I believe, now looking back at it, this idea of like, we're just being honest. I'm being humble, I'm learning, I'm on a journey. There's an authority that's higher than I. And as they engage that together, that becomes the monkey bars and the slides of the playground of the next 100 years of prayer. This humbleness and humility and a willingness to engage together. So as I wrap up this teaching, what has God been speaking to you? Is there an invitation here to engage prayer like this more or differently? And I would just leave you one more time with the words of the psalmist in Psalm 32. As you engage who you truly are, count yourself lucky. How happy you must be. You get a fresh start. Your slate's wiped clean. Count yourself lucky. God holds nothing against you, and you're holding nothing back from him. When I kept it all inside, my bones turned to powder. My words became day-long groans. The pressure never let up. All the juices of my life dried up, and then I let it all out. I said, I'll come clean about my failures to God, and suddenly the pressure was gone. My guilt dissolved. My sin disappeared. These things add up. Every one of us needs to pray. When all hell breaks loose and the dam bursts, we'll be on high ground, untouched. As we continue to learn to confess what is true, part of the gift that we have when we come together is that we get to sing and confess what's true. So for those who are able and willing, let's stand and sing together.